UCAT grads have the advantage that they've already gone through the agile mindset. All these academies are doing scrum teams, they're doing sprint life cycles, they're teaching them the practices of agile, and their entire life cycle and their entire training is based off of agile mindset.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, I'm joined by John Harden. John is the principal software engineer at Karanu. Karanu is a workflow and communication software company that just raised a $25 million Series A. When John's not leading a high-growth development team, he's mentoring for two coding academies, 1150 and Kinsey Academy here in Indianapolis. In this episode, we talk about his experience both hiring and mentoring coding bootcamp alumni. Software is eating the world. There just aren't enough traditional computer science grads to fill the demand for software engineers. Increasingly, high-growth teams are opening up their hiring to non-traditional backgrounds. That's why we're excited to learn from John's experience. This conversation is a great primer for how to hire and effectively onboard Code Academy grads. For others who have hired bootcamp grads, I'd love to hear about what you wish you would have known before you made that first hire. Tweet at me, at Wes Winham, and let me know about your experience. And now, here's my conversation with John Harden. John Harden, thanks so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Wes, thanks for having me over here.
So, John, what brought you into engineering leadership?
So, my story is a little bit of a long one on the engineering leadership, but this June, I celebrate my 10 years over at the Karanu company. So, the engineering leadership has been something that I've kind of earned internally at the organization. I kind of went, you know, a little bit different paths. I know that the shelf life, a lot of times, when you look at engineers and the code and in the day-to-day process, sometimes feels closer to a couple to a few years, but where I've been able to afford the luxury over here at Karanu is I've got some great leaders over here that have really invested in me early. And what I really like to do and how I like to help this organization aligns with where they're trying to take the company. And so it's just been kind of a fortunate alignment. You know, I've had the opportunity to really push myself as far as I want at this organization. They took the training wheels off pretty early for me, and I can't thank them anymore for that. So really, it was just a good alignment with the leadership. We have great communication internally, and what I want is what they want. So that it's just been kind of a really lucky path for me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about those investments they made into you? I think that's something we all aspire, is to invest in our teams to help them succeed. So I'd love to hear what that looked like for you.
It really began because I started with the company early in my life, honestly. I started with them pre-college, but it was just some of the small things just to make sure that I stuck around and was there for them the whole time. You know, while I was in college, they were allowing me to work remote as much as I want. When I was early in my career, they made sure that I always had kind of a mentor and somebody internally that can help me grow. That's one thing I always tell people that are kind of early off in their careers, is finding that mentor is so much more critical than another, $5,000 or whatever it may be. Those mentors are one of those things that are just going to catapult you in your career. So provided me the opportunities with mentors internally, and those mentors stretched from engineering mentors, where I was learning new things and new practices that I didn't know before, to business operation mentors, people that included me when, I was an engineer on a product, but I'm in the meeting deciding, how do we sell the product and how do we market the product and how do we service the product? Now, sounds probably a lot more resonating with some of the startup groups that we have here internally. And it's changed a lot over the years. But the big thing was really just investing and knowing that, you know, I'm here for the company and the company's here for me. And so it's that kind of relationship that you can't put right into words, but you know when you come in day to day that, you know, you've got somebody who's got your back and they know I'm here to get their back as we grow and scale.
So now that you're in the position to make sure that mentorship happens, how do you know when to take those training wheels off? And what does that look like for folks on your team?
So there's always a little bit of a joke. And I tell the people in the interview phase, you know, Carano isn't a shallow and deep end. It's the shallow end of the Mariana Trench. So I'm probably a little bit aggressive with the deep end. Yeah. The very deepest of the ends. You know, I'm probably a little over the top when it comes to taking off the training wheels internally, because when I came in, you know, those training wheels were ripped right off and thrown away. But what I think it does is it grows the individual really quickly. Now, here's the thing is that works as long as that individual that you're working with understands that they're allowed to fail. You know, it's not fair to put somebody in the deep end and then if they start sinking, you know, holding their head under the water. So it's all about, you know, what I think a great phrase one of our leaders internally, Don, likes to say a lot of time is get comfortable with being uncomfortable. So I try to really instill that on my team members internally too that I'm working with, right? It's about being uncomfortable. And that's something that is beyond just being an individual on an engineer. That's something that goes, and I think if you're a startup leader or you're a scale-up leader, you can attest to. You need to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. It needs to be okay to fail. And if you focus on growth and focus on failure as an opportunity for growth, I think it's just a whole different way of looking at things. And just that small way of looking at things, I think, is what makes people feel comfortable with failing. And I think as long as you embrace that, your team's going to grow pretty naturally.
One of the most common stories I hear about hires that don't work out is the contour is given a big project, kind of went dark, didn't ask for help, failed, and that became unacceptable because they waited too long. Versus what you're saying is failure is important, and usually that involves like raising your hand. How do you help your team know that they need to raise their hand? They need to talk about the failure before it's, you know, too late.
I mean, depending on the organization, you know, I've been here at Carano when we were five, so I get the give a guy a project or give a gal a project and let them run with it. But I think everything's got to be really team focused. And I think you've got to have a healthy mix of those engineers that really put their heads down and won't ask the questions with the people that might annoy that person with too many questions. So finding a good, healthy balance and striking that. I do think it's okay to fail. I can see where you're coming from, right, though. It's not okay to fail and not try to get help. So forcing functions. There's stage appropriate process in every business, so you don't want to overwhelm anything with process. But there can
what does the stage appropriate process look like for you at your scale to help folks not to go heads down too long and fail?
Well, we are big fans of things called tech jams here, so we like to do tech jams quite a bit. Anytime we've got a new story or a research spike that we're looking at, you know, we always try to put a tech jam together with a healthy mix of people. So we try to get, you know, the typical people that are probably going to be working on that said component, but then pull in other engineers that are working on other things. It's just an exercise where it's an hour or two where you're talking from the bottom up on the problem. But just getting people in a room and talking about the problems can really unveil a lot of things. It's super easy in like that kind of startup scale up mindset that we just have to get things done. There is no time to stop and think about it. We just have to get it done. We've already got a customer with a 2-week deadline. We don't have time to stop and talk. But, you know, as any engineer that's kind of been around the block for a while, no matter how good or how bad they may be, they should at least be able to admit that, you know, by bringing everybody together, you're going to come to a better solution. So I think tech jams are a really good process. We try to always put a tech jam on a, we have research spikes, which are basically the next work we're going to do in the following sprint. And then we try to do tech jams on them before the sprint gets here. So we don't have that impending feeling of, oh no, we've got to get it done in this, you know, 2-week period. Yeah, clock started. Yeah. So trying to get those spikes in front of the actual work is a beneficial way to try to make sure that everybody's communicating. And then those people that kind of were in that tech jam will collaborate together, you know, as they're working on the project in the next sprint. Even if they're not talking, they can always kind of bounce ideas back and forth.
I love that tech jam idea, swarming a problem early to get more brains on it. Could you talk us through maybe some things you've learned about how to run one of those effectively, or maybe just talk us through an example of one you've done recently, how you chose who to get in the room, how you set context. How could we use this technique in our organizations?
Tech jams are really healthy as long as you keep it concise, right? So everybody's been in one of those meetings where the topic started as one thing, and by the time 20 minutes has gone by, you've switched between 15 different topics. You've talked about 100 different things. And sure, they might be around the problem, but they're not talking about the problem itself. So the key focus there is kind of, is the word I just said, is focus, right? Is focusing on the problem. Now, depending on the problem, it kind of is different what that meeting cadence might look like, but really making sure that you're taking an active insight onto the tech jam and making sure that you're talking about the topics key. Because I know that sounds really fundamental, but everybody's been in those scenarios.
Fundamentals are important.
Gone away, yeah.
How do you keep that? So how many folks do we have in a room right now at this tech gym? Are we like 3 people? Are we 6 people? What would you recommend?
We try to keep it at like anywhere between 3 to 5. We try to keep it pretty small. And
are we gathered around one computer? Are we like, or do we have like, here's a topic on the whiteboard? How do you keep us all focused?
You can't see us here on the podcast, but every room here in Corano has at least 2 or 3 whiteboards. So we just go in one of the whiteboard rooms, clean everything off from the day before and get after it. There is usually, we try to at least have somebody running the tech jam. It's not kind of a free-for-all, you know, setting the agenda before the tech jam of these are the X amount of topics that we want to tackle, whether it's just 5 things, whether what is the right technology, what is the right tool, what is the right platform, what does the scale look like, identifying some key questions and then tackling it, and then just trying to make sure you walk out of the room with the answers. But having a leader in the room that's going to run the room and make sure that people that might be a little bit more quieter get their opportunity to speak. And then, you know, the key thing there is making sure that everybody in that room, once again, knows that they're not wrong. So if somebody says an idea, it needs to be a comfortable room to say ideas that sound crazy. Because if it's that crazy scale of ideas that eventually lead to that one idea that you're like, wow, that's genius. So I think you're on a fine line of conserved and crazy before you get to that genius scale.
So we need to keep the room small. We need to have a facilitator that's going to make sure that folks are required to get a chance to talk. We're working through a preset agenda, and we're setting a culture of there aren't wrong answers. You know, we can build on each other's ideas. I love that. I love those guidelines. Now I'd like to switch and talk about boot camps and coding academies. I understand you've had a lot of experience there. Could you tell us about your experience working with coding academy graduates?
I'm a curriculum advisor, an internal advisor over at 1150 Academy. I've been with the Academy now for 2.5 years, I think, since they were back at Scott Jones. I like to call it the castle, but if you've ever seen it, it really kind of is a castle.
I've been down the wooden slide, which is an interesting experience in somebody's house.
It is, yeah. So I've been with them. And then I also mentor even over at Kinsey Academy. So I've got a little bipartisanship here, but I've really been involved with them early with Corano as a way to engage and kind of get into that talent pipeline and identify a unique source of talent. So I've been with them since the very beginning. I've done everything from mock interviews with the actual engineers that are going through the camp. I've done curriculum review at the end of the graduating cohort to help them understand what Corano needs and what we're seeing as a need in the area. And I've gone as far now that we actually have, through the Corano engineering team, we've had 3 engineers join and be promoted internally within the organization, 2 of which are still here. One that's taken an opportunity to go to a new startup here in the local Indy and trying to get back at that foundational layer that I had gotten in at.
Yeah, that sounds like some broad experience. I would love to learn more about what you've learned now. You've hired 3. You've seen success with all 3. What are maybe some things that you know now that you wish you would have known back at the beginning before you hired those folks and learned through experience?
First off, to say it's been an amazing experience. It's one of those things that I didn't anticipate the amount of success that we'd have with it. But what are some of the things that we've learned? You know, you got to keep in mind if you're hiring from one of these boot camps, You're not hiring by any means a seasoned engineer. You're not hiring somebody that's gone through a traditional 4 year of schooling and may have done a few years of programming. You might be hiring somebody that's as short as 16 weeks. We hired a veterinarian technician that was here for, she was a vet tech for 2 years, decided it was time for her career to change. Then she switched into being a software engineer and she joined us 3 months later. What I learned from that experience is that you got to have kind of a process in play to make sure that these people are successful and that these academy graduates are successful. And it's not a copy paste from any college hire pipeline that you might have or any college hire onboarding strategy that you have. It's a different one. It's a lot more focused on pair programming is absolutely critical, I think, when you're bringing in those junior engineers, because as a senior engineer, if you're listening, or if you're just an engineer by trade for a while, what you understand is that learning a code base is, it's a vast challenge. You've got just understanding the principles that they're doing, understand the methodologies that they're doing, and then finding those skeletons in the closet and making sure you get what's going on there. But with a junior engineer, they don't know really where to even begin. This is their first time ever coming into a code base, coming into a actual product or project. So starting them off with something small, but pushing them into a lot of different areas of the product. I know that sounds odd, but maybe a task that's...
lay us out like the kind of, what is the first couple of weeks? You hire a new bootcamp grad, you're excited, you know that pair programming is important. How does that operationalize? What does that look like for their schedule?
The first week is always about learning the product. I think that they've got to be able to understand the product that they're working in and their features and functionality. I think that there's a lot of one-on-one training. We assign them always a what we call ambassador, which is a person that they can ask anything. So it doesn't matter what it is. It's, what's our HR policy? Because some of these people might actually be the first job they've ever had. What are HR policies?
Yeah. So is this typically an engineer, someone on your team, or does it really matter?
Yeah, we try to grab a senior engineer. You always want to make sure that you've at least got a 1-to-2 or at least 1-to-1 ratio of senior talent with junior talent. You asked earlier what was some of the mistakes we made. At one point, we had pulled in. We were having such wild success with the juniors. We're like, well, what can it hurt to bring in another? And that's when we were 2-to-2 and we brought in 2-to-3 and we started to realize that 1-to-1 training kind of fell apart. So the ambassador's big, making sure that you have a lot of time booked out. This is one of those things that it's going to cost a lot up front to gain the value in the back end. It's not one of those things that you're not going to be able to hire an academy graduate and be able to flip them around and have them, adding to the sprint within even maybe the first month. I mean, they're adding value, but it's the value you're getting out of it is nowhere near the amount of time you're investing into it initially.
So are you, in that first month, are they assigned any, let's talk Scrum, I guess. Are they getting assigned any stories from the backlog, or are they just pairing with someone else who has stories? Or what would you recommend?
So as a way to get them more engaged in the team, we always try to give them the stories and then make them use their pair programming time to work on their project or on their task at hand, because that's going to make them have ownership. That is one of those things as an engineer you need to learn early is the ownership of your work. So we try not to put them in a position where they're pair programming with another engineer on their tasks, because what's going to happen there is that person may be in towards a deadline. And the priority of training that engineer goes right out the window because, you're focusing on getting your work done versus actually helping them. So making sure that the new academy graduate has their own workload is really important because they'll own it. Everybody wants to own their work. So giving them enough work, it's probably the deep end with them, not quite the Mariana Trench, but giving them a good enough amount of work that they can sink and swim. And then trying to make sure that they know that they can go to people. I think that open community, that open culture of everybody's here is willing to help is super critical for success for those kind of people.
How do you instill that? You can, and I know one of the tensions, anywhere you start new, it doesn't matter how confident you are. You see smart people, you know they're busy, you don't want to take their time. How do you help that junior engineer know what's the appropriate amount of time to ask for? What's the right amount? How do you do it?
Yeah, to take the pressure off, for the first couple weeks when a new engineer joins at Carano, at least a junior or higher, or typically juniors a little bit more fine-tuned, but with the junior and the cohort grads, they actually have a schedule. The first 2 weeks, they have pair programming on their calendar, and it's on that engineer's calendar. So it forces those interactions. You know, you make that right comment. It doesn't matter how confident you are. If you're going into a new space with a bunch of new people that you don't even know, it's really hard to break that ice. So structured ice breaking, I suppose we'll call it. So forcing functions and forcing meetings to happen. Everybody hates the meeting overwhelm. But at the end of the day, once you get them past those first couple of weeks, and I try to get them to pair program with every engineer, I look at pair programming as an opportunity, obviously, to get work done and to learn engineering principles. But it is a good opportunity as a social opportunity for engineers that may not feel as confident reaching out to everybody to meet each person on the team. Now that works at our size when we've got, you know, 12 to 15 engineers. When we're scaling up to 30, we're going to have to scale that back. But right now, still even with 12 to 15 people and across different scrum teams, it still makes sense to make sure that they pair program with everybody because we are all a team. It doesn't matter at the end of the day, right?
I love that idea. So if I'm the 16th engineer, in my first 2 weeks, I've got 15, are we talking like 1 hour blocks pair programming? What have you found to be about an hour per person?
Yeah, we do about an hour. You know, the ideal pair programming scenario is 15 minutes on, 15 minutes off, 15 minutes on, 15 minutes off, as far as you're switching behind the keyboard. But really, there's not that deep of a structure. It's whatever's working for them. You know, at the end of the day, if it's 15 hours of expense of time programming and nothing gets out of it, zero code gets produced, but they know everybody on the team and they feel confident of talking with everybody on the team, then that's a worthwhile exercise either way.
Yeah, and I think that even underplays the value of pair programming. I know personally, pairing with someone I have no idea what's going on, just the act of explaining that to another person, I write better code. I've found that over and over, even if someone that's not necessarily adding. I love that scheduled pair programming idea. So thinking about when can I hire a bootcamp grad versus when do I need someone with a computer science degree? How do you think about the roles you have open and when you can pull from either one of those wells?
And just to clarify, you're talking about maybe a recent graduate with a computer science degree and a recent graduate with the Coding Academy?
Zero professional years of experience. We've got, you know, May computer science software engineer grads versus blueprint grads. When do you think you really have to have a computer science grad versus when a bootcamp grad would be just a little more as effective?
You know, at the size of where we're at or where Carano's at and where startups and scale-ups are at, I think that you're really not going to get too much difference of a value out of either. I think that bootcamp grads have the advantage that they've already gone through the agile mindset. All these academies are doing scrum teams. They're doing sprint life cycles. They're teaching them the practices of agile, and their entire life cycle and their entire training is based off of agile mindset. Now, the computer science graduates are obviously going to have a lot more of those deep fundamental programming skills. You know, they're going to be able to come in. A lot of them are going to have a lot more mathematical skills. So if you're looking at a lot of more, you know, stringent, maybe you're looking at data or you're looking at building out processes and business process automation or something like that, you might find an advantage with a comp sci grad there just because they've got some of those math underpins and those computer science underpinnings. But I wouldn't say, you know, that we target bootcamp grads versus comp sci grads on different roles. Really what we find is, you know, Carano's at least is always just looking to hire great people. And either way, whether they're a computer science grad or a academy grad, there's going to be an expensive amount of time we have to invest into it. So I'll tell you quite honestly, you know, at the end of the day for me, and this is, you know, John speaking on a podcast while hiring, is it doesn't matter kind of what your credentials end up being. You know, the training that you get through the academies are going to give you an opportunity to write code immediately. You're going to be able to come in and be able to contribute to some layer. But it's all about that will and that drive and that ambition. And those aren't things that you learn at an academy or that you learn at a school. And those things just resonate in interviews, and it's really hard to put a pin on it. You can't put a data point during an interview and say, well, this guy's got a 10 out of 10 on ambition, but you can feel it. So I would say that, you know, I don't know if there are certain things that I would pin them up against for certain tasks. Maybe, like I said, if you're looking more mathematical, you might lean towards somebody with like a computer science degree.
So you've hired three bootcamp grads. Is there any capability, any experience, any skill they come in with that you found to be better than what you would expect from a computer science 22-year-old college grad?
Yeah, I think the soft skills end up actually being a little bit better. You know, computer science grads that are going for their degree are trained in how to be computer scientists, right? But they're not trained in how to do interviews. They're not trained in how to work in a professional setting. They're not trained in how to sit in a tech jam or on a scrum team and interact with their entire team. Whereas these academy graduates are actually going through real world training. They're at least in both the academies I'm familiar with, they've done mock interviews multiple times before they actually graduate. They've already interacted with businesses in the local area. So that might be just a shadowing of an engineer as a practice that they do, or that might be, the academies really promote networking in the area. So that might be the meetups that they were incentivized to go out to and meet people. So I think that a lot of the times you're getting some advantageous from the boot camps, or some advantages rather from the boot camps around those soft skills. Not to say that comp sci people aren't going to walk out with soft skills, but it's something that they have to want themselves and they have to focus on, whereas the academy makes it part of the structure and part of the curriculum.
That is a drum I like to beat, about the lack of team skills in computer science and software engineering curriculum. There's still a big university, at least here in Indiana, that you can graduate with a computer science degree without using source control. And that's just still a little bit embarrassing to me. If you could spread one belief out into the zeitgeist about hiring and engineering management you think would really push our industry forward, what idea would you spread?
I know this one sounds like it's an expensive endeavor, but I really think that ratio that I brought up earlier of that 1 to 2 or 2 to 1 or 1 to 1 of keeping junior talent and senior talent is really critical.
Two seniors to one junior,
yeah.
Up to 1 to 1. But not
yes.
More juniors than seniors.
Not two, yeah. Okay. More seniors than juniors. And I know that that sounds like a lot, because you're spending a lot of time onboarding, a lot of time training. But, you know, we invested in this group of three juniors probably 2 years ago, and we invested a lot of time and a lot of training. But I can tell you, when I look at our team, I mean, these are three really critical contributors, or two really critical contributors. Because these are the people that know that we took the risk. These are people that are invested in the company, and they're cornerstones of our team, quite frankly. And not to say that the seniors are not, but when you take somebody and you give them that opportunity and you take a risk on them, and they know that you've done it and they know that time you've invested in them, they're really a lot more inclined to be sticking around with the organization. And they really are going to be able to stick around just because they have so much growth opportunity. You know, a lot of engineers, I joked earlier, there's kind of a 2 to 3 year lifespan. It might be because, you know, what they're finding is they're going to a company and they feel locked into their position. If you're coming in as a senior, it might be really hard to move to that next caliber. But when you're coming in as a junior and you've got a ton of malleability and you've got a ton of opportunity of growth, I think you're going to get a longer lifespan, and I think you're going to get a lot more value because they're really contributing and they're determined to make the team successful because you've invested that into them and you've instilled those layers of, we want to invest in people. And that resonates for the people that we like to hire here at Corano.
I love the medium and long-term benefit. Let's say someone listening is skeptical. They say, I love the medium and long-term. That makes sense. But I've only got 3 recs open this year. I've got to make every hire count. Do you think there are any short-term benefits to hiring those juniors that might be able to pay off to help kind of persuade that marginal hiring manager?
Yeah, well, I think that, if you look at the industry rates of hiring junior engineers, that is an advantage that the academies promote is, I mean, if you can hire one great talent, you might be able to squeeze in two junior talents. So your 3 rec might actually go to 4. But besides the economic advantages, you know, the juniors are going to come in with a lot of questions that I wasn't ready for, and they're going to fine tune process that you may not have fine tuned. It's interesting how much somebody that does not have that experience forces you to fix flaws in your process. Everybody's probably heard the analogy: as a company scales, the cracks in the sidewalk get bigger and bigger and bigger because the sidewalk gets bigger. You've heard something similar. But when you bring in somebody that's got little actual business experience or little professional experience or maybe professional software engineering experience, they kind of find out those little cracks and trip on them before they get too big. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting exercise because you really have to push yourself as an engineering leader and as somebody that's really investing in people. And you have to ask yourself, how am I going to make sure this person's successful? And I can tell you it's a lot different answer than if you ask yourself, how am I going to make a senior successful? Because you take a lot of things for granted with senior talent. But when you really bring somebody in that's fresh and that's green, it does force you to look at your strategy and your process a lot.
Fix those cracks in the sidewalk while they're still medium size. You wait another year, wait 2 years to hire your first junior. They're going to fall in those cracks. I love that analogy. I think folks familiar with the benefits of continuous delivery and the counterintuitive nature of deploy more often, I'll have less bugs. I think this is very analogous. I love that.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. After raising a big round of funding, Karano is growing their engineering team fast. They don't have much time to spend on hiring. That's why they partner with Woven. Our team improves their candidate experience while reducing the amount of time they have to spend on screening applicants. We triage their applications daily, and we put all candidates through a scenario-based technical screening. Then we provide detailed feedback to every single candidate. Their applicants give their experience 5-star reviews, and their engineering team only spends time interviewing candidates with a proven ability to do their specific job. At Woven, the first thing we do with our customers is 3 to 5x their inbound candidate volume. We just took a customer from 5 to 60 candidates per week. It's not magic, it's just a checklist of things that make a big difference in job board marketing. Today, I'm offering that inbound sourcing review for free to listeners of our podcast. You can go to woventeams.com/free to schedule with me. Again, if you want to 3 to 5x your inbound candidate flow, go to woventeams.com/free.
So John, now we're going to move into the rapid fire round. I'm going to give you a short question and then you're going to give me your rapid fire response. Are you ready?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
What does a best possible culture fit look like at Karano?
Somebody that understands where startup scale up or where scale up that wants to focus on growth, and somebody that wants to invest into a company that is going to be here for a long time and that's going to be really big with a lot of opportunity. So an opportunity taker.
What do you think is more important, soft skills or hard skills?
Right now, I'm going to say soft skills at our stage. That's probably going to change over our growth, but you can't have any prima donnas on the team, and you can't have anybody that's not willing to grow. So those soft skills, we can grow the hard skills here at Karano, but I think the soft skills you got to have coming in.
John, what's a mistake you've seen someone make in an interview that they didn't realize they were making?
I think the biggest mistake I've seen somebody make in an interview is they didn't realize was that they were answering questions they didn't know, and it was really obvious. I think they thought they were tricking me, but it was very clear. So I think that that's kind of the biggest mistake you can do is try to act like you know something you don't.
Thanks again to John for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, finding a mentor is critical to onboarding success. When we're onboarding any new teammate, dedicated time and attention is a huge benefit. This is especially true for junior candidates. By assigning a one-on-one mentor for new hires, we can both shorten their learning curve and increase camaraderie on our team. John makes mentorship a vital component of onboarding. Number two, use tech jams to start together. John's team finds a ton of value in doing tech jams before they start development on new features. They get brain power in a room together to explore how a feature will be used and the best architecture choices. By getting the entire team together, John is able to find the best solution instead of settling on the first solution. A successful tech jam follows four primary rules. The group involved is small. The moderator ensures that everyone has an equal voice. They have a preset agenda, and no idea is too crazy. Number three, bootcamp grads can be a huge value add, but they require their own growth path. A common mistake is expecting fresh out engineers to produce on day number one. John has made a massive value add to his team by hiring bootcampers and giving them a dedicated growth path. He doesn't expect them to contribute to sprints right away, and he pairs them with a senior engineer to help them learn faster. It also helps the senior engineer. This dedicated growth path can take a bootcamp grad and turn them into a productive junior engineer. Thanks again to John for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever else you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next week.